Welcome back to New Books in Latino Studies. I'm David James Gonzalez, the host of today's podcast. And as a reminder to our listeners, you can subscribe to and rate this program on iTunes or Stitcher, where in addition to our website, newbooksinlatinostudies.com, all of our previous interviews may be streamed or downloaded for free. For today's program, I'm speaking with Peter Wade and Carlos Lopez Beltran, editors along with Eduardo Restrepo and Ricardo Ventura Santos of Mestizo Genomics, Race, Mixture, Nation, and Science in Latin America, published by Duke University Press in 2014. Peter Wade is professor of social anthropology at the University of Manchester. His research focuses on the concepts of race, ethnicity, and gender in Latin America, and more particularly on Black identity and social movements in Colombia. Carlos Lopez Beltran is a historian of science and senior researcher in the Instituto de Investigaciones Filosóficas Universidad Nacional Autónoma de México. His research specializes in the historical and philosophical study of the life sciences, with a particular focus on the notion of inheritance. Both of our guests have published extensively in their fields, with numerous books, articles, essays, and awards attributed to their names. Carlos today joins us from Mexico City, and Peter joins us from Manchester, England. I begin by asking them to tell us a little bit more about themselves, both their personal and professional backgrounds. First, we'll begin with Peter, and then move on to Carlos.
Okay. Well, I started by doing field work in Colombia on issues of race and racial discrimination, racism. And that has been, race in Colombia and in Latin America generally, has been the kind of guiding thread of my studies. I also did a project about the social history of music in Colombia, interested in particularly how racial meanings got attached to music in the 20th century. And then more recently, I started working with a colleague on issues around genetics and assisted reproduction in Europe. So that was what sparked my interest in genomics. So then I came up with the idea of doing a project, a comparative project around genomics and nation and race in Latin America. And I knew that Carlos had already started working on those things. He was one of the first people I contacted to collaborate on the project.
Great, thank you. Carlos, a little bit about you yourself.
I started studying biology, and then I moved into the history and philosophy of biology. I did my PhD in England, and the subject of my research, early research, was the concept of heredity. Then that moved on to some interest in the notion of race. I did my PhD in England. When I came back to Mexico, I got interested in trying to figure out how heredity and race had worked in the Mexican scene, and eventually I got interested in more contemporary stuff. My first research was all historical, and the genomic projects, the international genomics projects were booming in that time. So I started doing research in genomics in Mexico with a group of people at UNAM. That's when Peter Wade contacted me to start this international collaboration, which suited us fine.
Great. Thank you for that, Carlos. Peter, I believe you were the impetus behind this project. So will you explain how this project came about, that is, how you selected your team and how the project was conceptualized as an ethnographic study of genetic research labs in Mexico, Colombia, and Brazil?
Well, I should say, I mean, neither of us mentioned it, but Carlos and I knew each other from when he did his PhD in Cambridge, and I was at that time a postdoctoral fellow in Cambridge. So I already was acquainted with him, and then I also knew that he'd been working recently on genomics and genomic medicine and the Institute, the National Institute for Genomic Medicine in Mexico. So I knew that he was working on those issues. And I became, as I said, I've been already interested in the relationship between race and genetics and genetics and social life in general. So I came up with the idea of doing a comparative study. I also knew that Ricardo Ventura Santos in Brazil had been working on these kinds of themes for quite a while, and he'd already sent me some of his papers. So he was an obvious point of contact too. And then, of course, I was the kind of the Colombia person in that three-way comparison. So those were the three countries that that attracted my attention, where I knew stuff had been going on around and I knew people had been working on those sorts of issues. Then the way that the project came together, I mean, I tried various funding sources, which, you know, did or didn't work. And eventually the one that came through was the ESRC, which is the British Economic and Social Research Council, which is the government body that funds social science research in the UK. And they have quite an open attitude towards bringing on board international collaborators. So it was quite easy to nominate overseas academics, these kind of, you know, co-applicants on the project. So that was the structure of the project, was that, you know, in each country there would be a co-applicant. So for Colombia, because I was, and I couldn't be the co-applicant because I was the principal applicant, so I contacted somebody who I'd known for many years in Colombia, an anthropologist called Eduardo Restrepo, who wasn't working specifically on genomics, but was interested in race and blackness and so on in Colombia. So yeah, I put together this comparative project with a co-applicant in each country, with me as the kind of the director of the project, and then contracted a research associate, a postdoctoral fellow, to actually do the research in each country. And they worked closely with Carlos and Ricardo and Eduardo. And then the structure of the project also allowed a local research assistant to be hired in each country to help the main researcher and the local co-applicant. So that was the kind of the way the project worked. And then each postdoctoral fellow did 9 months field work. And then, you know, we did a preparatory phase of three or four months where we were all together in Manchester reading stuff and thinking about how to do the project. Then each one went to their country and did the actual field work, and then came back to the UK and wrote up.
Thank you. Wow. Well, this is certainly a fascinating project, and I'd like to talk a bit more about the driving questions behind your approach to the study, particularly how ideas about race, nation, and gender enter into the work of genetics laboratories. Perhaps, Peter, would you like to begin? And then we'll move on and have Carlos add his thoughts.
I think the main point of interest was how concepts of race and nation, and as it turned out, also gender, although that wasn't something we were anticipating necessarily, but, you know, it's impossible to think about race without thinking about gender, especially in Latin America. So it wasn't surprising that it cropped up. So the idea was to see how those concepts entered into the work that geneticists were doing around human population diversity in Latin America. That was the kind of fundamental idea of the project. So, you know, in that, there wasn't an idea of a simple relationship between science, two sort of separate spheres called science and society.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I mean, that's one way of thinking about it, but that's not what we wanted to do. We wanted to look at how concepts of race and nation and gender, and specific concepts like, you know, negro, black, or indio, indígena, indigenous person, or mestizo especially, and white, blanco, or branco, how those concepts entered into the construction of genomic projects, and how those concepts were represented in the way that geneticists handled their data and reported their data. So that's what we were interested in.
Right. And Carlos, I'd like to have you explain, if you will, a bit about how this particular study contributes to a field that I know you're very much involved in, which is, you know, the social studies of science. What particular interventions?
Mm-hmm. Well, fascinating aspect of this particular project is that people that were gathered around it by Peter Wade and by Ricardo and Eduardo and me were coming from different backgrounds,
right.
Many anthropologists, but also social students of science, and myself, I'm a historian. And this the diversity of disciplinary background was really an asset. We managed to really establish a common ground. And yes, the historical aspects were very important to create a comparatory framework from these three different countries. Because although each country, Mexico, Colombia, and Brazil, have very similar population histories, they are a product of the coming together of peoples from three different origins, at least, African, European, and original American populations. Each one has a set of particular ideological and political arrangements around race and around mestizaje. And so we wanted to really have both the historical and the contemporary frames in place before we could begin to ask questions about how similar or how different things worked in the space of genomics in these three countries. And it was really fascinating to see that there was a lot of communication between the disciplinary languages, and we managed to produce a work that is relevant for all of them.
Thank you for that response. The book's introduction points out that notions of race, ethnicity, and gender operate differently across time and space and place. Again, the focal point of this study is Latin America, and in particular, Mexico, Colombia, and Brazil, and how the unique histories of race mixture intersect with contemporary genetics research and popular discussions about it. Before we get into a discussion of your case studies, will you discuss the work of genetic scientists? That is, what is it that they do? What are their goals? And how has genomics research developed over the past 25 years or so? Peter, would you like to start us off?
Genetic studies started in Latin America, obviously, very early on, in the 1930s or even before. And from the very beginning, they were sort of self-consciously engaged in something that was generally called racial studies. They were trying to characterize different sorts of human beings in terms of their genetic makeup. And from the start, also in Latin America, there was a strong interest in mixture, in how to measure mixture, how to calculate for mestizo populations, what percentage of African ancestry they had, etc., or what percentage of European ancestry. So that was a focus of interest right from the start, just in its own terms. They were interested in that in its own terms. But very quickly, those sorts of there was also an interest in the relationship between genetics and medicine. So that's been kind of major driver for a lot of the work around genetics and genomics. So a lot of what they're after, the geneticists, is to try and trace genetic variants that are linked to what they call, nowadays anyway, complex disorders. That is to say, disorders that have probably some genetic component, but it's unknown how much or exactly what it is. So things like heart disease, diabetes, obesity, these kinds of conditions that have some genetic component probably, but also a strong sort of environmental component. So there's a lot of money being invested into trying to track down what are the genetic variants that predispose people towards, let's say, diabetes or obesity or cardiovascular disease, and how to then perhaps intervene in those genetic variants so that you can create public health policies that are directed towards genetic medicine that can perhaps be tailored to specific populations or even specific individuals in terms of their collective or individual genetic profile. So that's what's driving a lot of the genetic medicine. But those kinds of goals those are the kind of ultimate, the holy grail, if you like. That's what drives the whole enterprise.
Right.
But especially in the last 10, 15 years, there's been a sort of, significant rowing back from the promises that people were making, let's say in the 1990s, when rapid sequencing sort of took off and people were able to generate millions of megabytes of data or gigabytes of data, from genomic experiments and so on. And people were suddenly, at that point in the 1990s, they were very optimistic about how they were going to crack everything, and come up with solutions to these kinds of diseases, etc. And in the last, 15, 20 years, suddenly geneticists have, or not suddenly, but gradually, geneticists have realized that things are a great deal more complex than that, and that really they're a long way off from designing effective genetic therapies that will really give the answers to these kinds of problems. So in the meantime, they continue to sample populations and to characterize them in genetic terms. And in the case of Latin American populations, there's still a continuous interest in defining their genetic ancestry in terms of what percentage of Amerindian, African, and European right. ancestry they have. That's a kind of constant concern. So that kind of whole scenario that I've just laid out defines a kind of global genomic science. All geneticists all over the world are interested in solving those kinds of problems around medicine. The other thing that the other driving force behind that is to try and work out how the world was populated, going back into ancient history, to track the process of migration through which the whole world was populated. And you can use genomics to help you work that out as another source of data alongside archaeology and so on. So those are kind of big global genomic projects, medicine, the peopling of the world and so on. Now, within Latin America, that's the international dimension of genomic
right.
projects. Within Latin America, and not just Latin America, but elsewhere as well, there's also a kind of national dimension, which is that it is possible to say something about the population of your particular nation using these kinds of data.
Right,
whether
right.
it's whether you want to talk about the United Kingdom or Brazil or Mexico or whatever. So these geneticists who are partaking in these international collaborations, they're publishing in English language journals that are internationally read and so on. They also have another side to their work, which says something about, what is Brazil? What is the Brazilian population like? What is Mexico? How can we characterize our national population? So there's that interesting kind of tension between the global and the national.
Right.
We're kind of interested in to see, what kind of narratives do these geneticists come up with about their particular nations?
Gotcha. Thank you. Carlos, anything that you want to add to
Peter Singer? I think Peter has pretty much summed up the important general things. I'll add something about the feeling, a long-term feeling that Latin America has been a kind of a natural experiment in terms of heredity and genetics since its modern history. And especially when the genomic revolution started, there was a feeling in most geneticists in Latin America that they had the opportunity to hook up with the world developments by addressing the local genetic diversity of human populations in all these aspects that Peter was pointing out, the historical original population of the Americas. How can we complement the narratives we already have from historians or from archaeologists? And then, of course, the health issue, which as you know, recently, all these complex diseases like diabetes, obesity, hypertension, etc., have developed into have acquired epidemic proportions in Latin America, in countries like Mexico, and to try to use the particularities of Amerindian genetic origins, for instance, was seen as an opportunity once we had these genomic tools to try to address these very, very urgent health issues. So Latin American geneticists and Mexican geneticists in particular, human geneticists, pretty much moved into the scene with these new tools and started using this traditional classificatory notions for American populations, mestizo, Amerindian, black, etc. And I think it also set the scene for people like us to pay attention, because it was an opportunity to really see science in action and this complex interactions between identitary notions like mestizo and scientific notions like genetic admixture coming together and producing interesting results.
Right. Thank you. You know, as Peter mentioned some of the initial promises of genetic science, it reminded me of a point made in the book's introduction regarding how these ideas are transmitted to the public. And in particular, one of the promises of genetic science was that it would move society beyond more traditional notions and racialized discourses of people and cultures. But one of the key findings of your study actually challenges this assumption. Will you discuss how the findings of genomic science are transmitted to the public sphere in ways that reinforce more traditional notions of race, ethnicity, and culture that essentially view or rank groups according to a racial hierarchy? Perhaps, Carlos, would you like to begin?
Yes, I think this is part of one of the things that were very interesting to us when we started the project. And actually, there was a second phase to the project after we did the laboratory studies and all the interpretations about how scientists were interacting with the more general notions of racialized notions. The second part of the project, we addressed what was going on with the publics and how the publics were receiving this genomic based information in terms of racialized categories. And so we did also research with groups in Brazil and Colombia and Mexico with the publics that were actually consuming in different ways, interacting with these notions. And there's a recent issue in Social Studies of Science, the journal, where our group also published this aspect of the research. And this is one of the issues where the diversity really comes up, because in Mexico, the public uses the genetic information in really very, very matter-of-fact way. It chimes with how people see themselves and conceive their origins and their bodies. This notion of the mestizo and mestizaje as being really what makes a Mexican is somehow being translated or conceptualized in terms of genes or in terms of genes of with different origins, and people are not very anxious about what this is doing to their identities or to their histories, whereas in Brazil and Colombia things are a bit different. Probably
gotcha.
Peter
can comment. Yeah. Yeah. Can I chip in there?
Yes, yeah. Please.
One of the things that, if you read the literature about genetics and public science and so on, one of the things that that academics are saying is that, you know, the whole of society, or Western society anyway, is undergoing a process of geneticization, whereby people are increasingly thinking of their identities and their relationships and their senses of belonging and history and so on, using genetic idioms and using genetic data.
Right.
So, for example, you know, the fact that you can take a swab from the inside of your mouth and put it in an envelope and send it off to a DNA ancestry testing company,
exactly,
in the USA, and pay $300-$400, and they'll tell you about your ancestry. Apparently, anyway, this kind of thing. So, you know, and there's a whole series of debates around whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, whether that leads to kind of more reductionist or determinist ways of thinking, or whether, you know, et cetera. So that was one thing that we were interested in. And what we found was that, you know, that the data, I mean, the people we were working with, you know, it wasn't very clear. That trend wasn't very clear. And the reason is that quite a lot of the literature that focuses on that process of geneticization looks at very particular kinds of data. They talk to you often, anyway, people who have a vested interest in genetics. So they talk to patient associations, that is to say, people who've got, who are, you know, who suffer from particular conditions that are clearly connected to genetics. So, you know, you talk to them, and of course they're going to be very clued up about genetics. They're going to think in terms of genetics because it's affecting their lives. Mm-hmm. Or you talk to people who have taken those DNA ancestry tests. So again, you're talking to a group of people who already have, and who are already invested in that way of thinking, or the possibility of that way of thinking about themselves. Or you look at representations. You look at, I don't know, CSI and things like that. And, you know, you look at the media and the way that the genetics are represented in the public sphere. And then you sort of extrapolate and think, oh, well, because it's being represented so much and there's so much talk and sort of media stuff about genetics, it must be having some kind of impact on, you know, the public in general. But when you talk to people who don't have a particularly this vested interest in genetics, who are just kind of ordinary students at university in Mexico, Brazil, Colombia, or whatever, you know, you don't find quite so much concern with genetics. They may or may not use a genetic idiom to talk about the diversity of their country, or, you know, particular problems they might have about in health or their family health and stuff like that. But it's not clear. You know, there's a much more uneven process of geneticization. So I think that was an important finding for us.
Certainly. So let's move on to a discussion of the case studies in the book. The first three chapters set the historical context for the ways in which ideas about race, gender, and nation have operated in Mexico, Colombia, and Brazil. Then the following chapters, 4, 5, and 6, present the findings of the ethnographic research conducted in those countries, particularly in the genomics research labs there. Perhaps we can start with the Mexican Genome Diversity Project in Mexico's National Institute for Genomic Medicine. Carlos, will you explain some of the key findings of your team? And particularly, maybe we can talk about the way natural cultural ideas about populations, regions, and notions of biogeographic ancestry find their way into defining research agendas and the selection of samples and the interpretation and presentation of data.
Well, this genetic diversity, human diversity project that IMGEN developed in the early part of the century, after 2004 to 2009, really had a very basic aim, that was to create a kind of a map or a database of variation, genetic variation in human groups within the Mexican territory. It was presented publicly a bit more grandiose way as being the Mexican Genome Project or the Mexican Mestizo Genome Project, mm-hmm. and that created a lot of confusion in my opinion. But the main results point to a mixed population, so they managed to quantify the percentage of African, Amerindian, and European origins of different, and they regionalize that. So in different regions within Mexico, you have a bit higher percentage of African presence in the coast, for instance, and you have also a gradient moving from north to south in terms of the amount of Amerindian genetic variants, and the other result was that there is a lot, well not a lot, but quite a bit of particular variants distributed within the Mexican territory that could be helpful if your aim is to try and do association studies related to medical conditions. So that was basically what IMEGEN was doing in this early period. Mm-hmm. And after that, there's been a series of other population genomic researches at different scales, at more local scales within regions in Mexico, and more broader scales in the Latin American dimension. And basically, I mean, the stage is set for a lot of very important medical research, I think. But as Peter was pointing out at the beginning, a lot of it is still standing there as a promise. So geneticists have a lot of work to do still.
Right, and sticking on, you know, on this, the Mexican case study, what is it that your researchers, you know, particularly found in relation to your project?
Well, we found that first there was a very clear distinction within the frames that the scientists were using between Mexican population in general as a mestizo population and the indigenous populations as a non-mestizo population, which, right. In genetic terms, it's a presupposition that it's turning out to be a bit too sharp. So the Mexican population is not so sharply genetically split between Indios and mestizos, but this more social and ideological idea of the split was playing a strong role at the beginning in how scientists were classifying their samples and how they were looking for special markers of indigeneity and things like that. So that was an interesting finding.
No, and that's really a key finding, right? And it really undergirds the purpose of this project, which is to, again, understand how and examine how those cultural notions, particularly of classificatory systems, according to race and ethnicity, are brought into the laboratory, right? And so this one is an example, one of them, right? The national conception of Mexico as a nation of mestizos, right? That's a cultural and national project that's very much a product mostly of the 20th century, but late 19th, early 20th century, post-revolutionary type thing. But as you mentioned here, so the simple classifying or looking for, right, indigenous DNA markers, right, is something that's brought into the lab, right?
Exactly. The paper in the book, written by Bibet Garcia Deister is a very nice example of how you can move from the blood sample to the molecular level and then to the. Are you still with me?
Yes, we're still here.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. And then to the more abstract level of the bytes and the databases, and you carry along and redefine what the mestizo is in each stage. And she does a wonderful work of describing that thing. Yeah.
Right. And what I find particularly really fascinating about this, I mean, about our cultural social world. You know, and how it intersects and is brought into, say, in this case, like a genetic research lab, is that I think outside of the laboratory, when we're talking about genetics testing and when people, as Peter mentioned, are sending in DNA samples, you know, the idea is that their expectation is that there is in that sweat swab that there's something that, you know, once it's put in there, right, put into whatever that swab is put into, right? That there's some type of computer formulation or something that's going to extract and tell them exactly how much of a particular ethno-racial group that they are, right? And that itself is, you know, a cultural, you know, presumption, you know, supposition, if you will, that is not necessarily intended, you know, in the lab itself, but, you know, something that happens when these two worlds, you know, start to merge and people outside of the labs try to understand what the purpose of this research is and how useful it can be, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's true. If you're talking about in a personal ancestry testing,
right,
then, you know, there's all kinds of I mean, that wasn't what we were particularly interested in, because that's not a widespread practice in Latin America. You know, you don't have these, you know, personal ancestry testing companies that will tell you about your ancestry. You have paternity testing and things like that. But yeah, so, you know, but those kinds of personalized ancestry tests are, there's lots of qualifications that one has to take into account around the kind of data that they give you. So, I mean, I think it's probably well known that, you know, Oprah Winfrey, for example, you know, when she tried one company, they told her that she was, you know, had a particular relationship with some African ethnic group, Zulu or so, whatever it was, I can't remember now. And then she tried another company and they told her something rather different. So, you know, all these companies use their own databases, which are proprietary databases that, you know, that only they have access to. And because human beings share the vast majority of their DNA, and because the markers that are associated with a given ancestry are, you know, that are used to mark, let's say, African ancestry, it's not, those markers aren't unique to Africans. They're just a bit more frequent amongst Africans. So it's all, you know, statistical calculations that allow you to make inferences about where, you know, your ancestors came from. And you can get lots of different answers depending on how you do those calculations and what kind of algorithms you use and what kind of databases you use.
Right. So this can lead us into a discussion of the Brazilian case study, which focuses on trying to find or resurrect, as the title of the chapter states, an extinct indigenous population in southern Brazil. Peter, will you explain the findings here?
Sure, yeah. I mean, this was of interest because, I mean, let me set the context for Brazil more generally. If in Mexico, one of the main things that came out was a kind of genomic reiteration of the distinction between the mestizo majority and the indigenous minority, mm-hmm. in Brazil, the main message that came across was the idea that race meant nothing.
Right.
You know, you couldn't divide up the Brazilian population in terms of these kinds of broad categories of indigenous, black, because all Brazilians were mixed. That was the kind of message that especially one very well-known Brazilian geneticist called Sergio Pena was very insistent about. Now, the project the researcher in question, which was Michael Kent, looked at, was a project that was focused on one particular region of Brazil in the far south, which is where there was a lot of European immigration, and so people are generally speaking sort of fairly white in Brazilian terms, and are often, you know, particular regions where they're very proud of their European ancestry and so on. But at the same time, one of the main things that came out of the Brazilian genetic work, not just that chapter but in general, was that all Brazilians, no matter if they consider themselves white or not, have, the chances are, they'll have some kind of indigenous and or African ancestry in their DNA, probably in the what's called the mitochondrial DNA, which is a particular type of DNA that you inherit only through the maternal line and that remains unchanged as it goes down through the generations. So that was a kind of, you know, even white Brazilians are mixed. That was the kind of message. Therefore, you know, race means nothing. Therefore, you know, white Brazilians who think that they're superior because they're white, actually they are also mixed. So, you know, there's no reason for them to feel superior. This was the kind of message that the geneticists were trying to get across. So what was shown in the case of the Chahua, of this particular southern Brazilian population or study of the population, was that you could find these kinds of indigenous ancestral markers. And in this case, they were linked to a particular indigenous group that had disappeared, called mm-hmm. the Chahu, who were famed as kind of warriors. You know, they were an indigenous group that didn't exist anymore because they'd been very, you know, rebellious, and they'd resisted colonization. They'd shrugged off the yoke of the colonial Portuguese, etc. There was this big sort of story about them, the warrior image of the Chahua. So in this case, you know, these people were kind of admitting, yeah, okay, we have an indigenous ancestry, but actually the kind of indigenous ancestry we have is, you know, quite valuable, and looks, you know, it's something we could valorize and mm-hmm. accept as part of our history, because it talks about rebellion and uniqueness and so on. So that was what came out of that chapter.
Thank you for sharing that. Carlos, did you have anything particularly on the Brazilian case study that you wanted to bring up?
Yeah, a couple of things. One is that Brazil could be seen as a relative exception in this lack of interest in Latin America in personal ancestry testing. It's the only region, as far as we know, where there are some people willing to pay money to private companies in order to find out things about their identity or about their origins with genetic tools. Whereas in Mexico or Colombia or other parts, if you ask people, if they were curious about their genetics and their relation to their ancestry, they would say they are, but not as curious as to be willing to pay for a test. So that's one thing about Brazil. The other is that the contentious arena where genetics is acting in Brazil is an arena of the policies of how do you call that, Peter?
Affirmative action.
In relation to the black population. So there's genetics is being yielded as a tool, as an argument by people in both sides of the dispute. Because if people in Brazil, as Peter was saying, are all mixed, they are more or less have different percentages of the same ingredients, there is no point in trying to separate or to make distinctions between the black populations and the rest of the populations. And so that's a scene where genetics is also crucial.
Yeah. Right.
And perhaps I could just add a little bit there.
Please do.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Carlos is right. This was an area where genetic data were deployed in the most obviously political way, in mm-hmm. the sense that, you know, people who were against particularly racial quotas in higher education in Brazil, which were brought in from about 2002, 2003, and created a huge debate in Brazil about whether it was morally right to create quotas for black students in higher education. So the people who were against that used these kind of genetic data to argue that, well, you know, blacks don't exist as a biological category, therefore they shouldn't exist as an object of social policy.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That was the most obvious kind of wielding or deployment of genetic data for overtly political purposes that we saw. And that wasn't just, you know, geneticists. I mean, one or two geneticists were making those kinds of arguments, but mainly it was policymakers and other kinds of commentators who were using these genetic data to make those kinds of arguments.
Right, and that illustrates a point made in the introduction and conclusion regarding the multicultural projects that are at work in each of these nations to varying degrees. So I'd also like to return to something Peter mentioned just a few minutes ago regarding the role gender plays in these studies. Peter, will you explain a bit more your team's findings on this?
Yeah. I mean, it shouldn't have been unexpected, really, because, you know, it's kind of obvious that the process of mestizaje, you know, the process of race mixture, you know, must involve gender relations, because it involves people having sex with each other. So, you know, it shouldn't have been really a surprise to us. But what we did find was that, you know, again and again and again in the genetic studies, the geneticist said, well, the data shows, especially the data from the mitochondrial DNA and the Y chromosome DNA, which is inherited down the paternal line, shows that the original encounters were between European men and indigenous women, or in the case of Brazil, especially African women. So the data shows that, because in the Y chromosome DNA, you can find lots of European markers, and in the mitochondrial DNA, you can find lots of indigenous and, in the case of Brazil, African markers. So, I mean, those are the data. You can't argue with those data. But, mm-hmm. You know, they were quite selective. You can find samples in Colombia, in Brazil, I'm not sure in Mexico, but certainly in Colombia and Brazil, you can find samples where the mitochondrial DNA is dominated by European markers, for example. And even more so, you can find cases in the Y chromosome, you can find samples where African and indigenous Y markers are very common, even the majority in the Y chromosome DNA. So, you know, the overall, there's quite a lot of variety. Nevertheless, the way that the geneticist talked about it sort of ironed out that variety. And all they said was the data shows this consistent pattern of European men having had sex with indigenous and African women at the beginning of, you know, the colonial period.
Right.
So, you know, what they were doing was simply reiterating a very well-known story. This was a very well-known, well-rehearsed narrative about the formation of Latin American nations, was that, you know, the conquistadores came over, they had sex with indigenous women, they had sex with African slaves, and herein was the birth. So the geneticists were reiterating this very well-known story about, you know, conquistadores coming over and having sex with indigenous women and slave women. Right. And creating the mestizo nation, etc. Like I was saying, you know, the majority of the data did indeed tell that kind of story, but there were other significant instances where a different story was going on. Because the kind of narrative that story creates was that only European men had the kind of sexual agency. Mm-hmm. You know, indigenous men and African men, you know, had no agency in that process. They weren't participating in the formation of the nation and so on. And then also, one of the implications was that indigenous and African women were totally kind of passive. Mm-hmm. They were just receivers of European men's attentions and so on. And also, the kind of language in which they described this process completely erased the kind of violence, the coercion, the rape, all the other kinds of things that surrounded the actual social relationships that were going on, not just during the colonial period, but early colonial period, but during the later colonial period and thereafter. You know, all they did was talk about the introgression of European genes into the gene pool, that kind of thing, without acknowledging the violence and the coercion that went on around that. Exactly. So they ended up kind of, you know, reproducing a kind of conservative notion of what the nation was and how it was formed.
Thank you. Yes. Carlos, you had a few things you wanted to...
Just a compliment to that. I think this is part of the research in Latin America that Peter was describing really shows why Latin America has very interesting aspects to reveal in the interaction between techniques, genetic techniques, particular genetic techniques, and ideological frameworks. Because if you look at it, both the Y chromosome and the mitochondrial chromosome are very small amounts of the human genetic information that have peculiarities that allow for inferences, very peculiar inferences that can tell you things about very remote past, and can tell you very little about what happened in between. But as it resonates, the narrative that you can construct with these techniques resonate with the highly ingrained prejudice or notions, then they kind of build up a retelling of these founding myths of the Amerindian woman being raped or being kind of incorporated either aggressively or passively within the macho Spanish conquista. And this is very similar to what happens with other techniques, like mixture techniques. Genetics is full of this inferential structures that depend in very particular analytic settings and experimental settings. And for some reason, Latin America tends to Latin American scene tends to be very adequate to interact in this, I don't know how to call it, questionable way, but very, very interesting way.
Great. Thank you both for explaining that a bit more. Before we conclude, is there another finding or two that either of you feel should be brought to the attention of our audience before we wrap up?
Yes, I think there's the one, there's a general point, which is that the relationship between genomics and the representation of the nation and the kind of turn towards multiculturalism that has occurred in Latin America since the 1990s. So all over Latin America since the 1990s, there's been a kind of an official recognition that the countries are multicultural, plurinational, whatever word one wants to use, and there have been legislative reforms that have recognized land rights for indigenous and Afro-descendant people in very uneven and varied ways, and so on. So what in that sense, the kind of genomic representations of the nation are quite interesting, because there's a kind of dual effect. On the one hand, these genomic representations of the nation separate out indigenous people, Afro-descendant people, and then the rest, which are mestizos generally. So in that sense, they're kind of reproducing the multiculturalist version of the nation, which is, we're a mestizo nation, but we also have these black and indigenous minorities who we have to recognize and acknowledge and protect and give rights to and so on. On the other hand, the geneticists were also saying, okay, well, we have these minority populations, but what we really are is we're mestizo. Mm-hmm. That's the truth of our national identity. We are mestizo. So, for the last 20, maybe 30 years, we've been preoccupied with these ethnic minorities. We recognize their culture. We recognize their land rights or not. There's a lot of variety here. And for 30 years, we've been preoccupied with this multiculturalism, which is really about minorities. That's what the multiculturalism is really talking about, just the minorities.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So really what we are, we should remember that really what we are is mestizos. That's what we are. So the genomic representation was a very powerful recentering of the idea that we are mestizos.
I'd like to add to that, probably a consequence of what Peter has just said is that mestizo is no longer a national identity classificatory notion. It's more like a plurinational. So in the case of Mexico, one thing that was obvious is that this aim of some Mexican geneticists of having a national research of the national genomic genetic variants was due to a kind of failure, because a high percentage of Mexicans are now crossing the border or are now living in the United States, and there's a lot of research being done in the United States with those populations that are being classified in different ways as Latino and Hispanic. And so the real scene of research now in this, for these racialized categories is more international or transnational than really, a nation cannot contain the genomic variants that it would wish to contain.
Great, and thank you both for adding those thoughts. What we'd like to do as we finish up traditionally on New Books in Latino Studies is ask each of you to tell us what it is you're currently working on, what new projects you have. So, Peter, perhaps we'll begin with you, and then Carlos.
For the last couple of years I've been working on, I've had a kind of research professorship, which has given me some time to write. So I've been working on a book, a kind of single-authored book, which really brings together all the diverse products from this project. So not just the collected, the book we're talking about today, Mestizo Genomics, was one product. Then Carlos mentioned the special issue of a journal of social studies of science, which came out in December last year. And then there have been lots of different journal articles that have, appeared independently in journals. So what I've been working on is a kind of a synthesis of all this stuff into a single book written by myself, which is also going to come out with Duke University Press probably next year, which is called Degrees of Mixture, Degrees of Freedom. So that's what I've been working on. And also I've got a new project starting in January, which is actually on a different theme. It's about the ethnography of anti-racist organizations in four Latin American countries, Brazil, Colombia, Mexico, and this time we added Ecuador. So that's what I've been doing.
Wonderful. Thanks. Carlos?
Well, I've been continuing some collaboration with my colleague, Vivette Garcia Deister, who was part of the project as a postdoc. We've been writing a series of papers on the mestizo as a scientific object, trying to go through the different periods of Mexican history. Now we are doing some research, and we're writing on the 20th century. And I've also been working a little bit on the Spanish translation of Mestizo Genomics, which is due to appear in the Fondo de Cultura Económica during the second half of this year. It should be presented in the Feria Internacional del Libro de Guadalajara. So we that's something that is also soon to appear. Yeah, there's going to be a Spanish version, and it will hopefully circulate in all Latin America. And I'm also going back to some older research that I left aside for during the works for this period on heredity and race in Mexico in 18th and 19th century.
Well, wonderful. All three of those projects sound just great. And again, I would just like to thank each of you, Peter and Carlos, for taking time out of your busy schedules, for coordinating them with me across continents. Again, Peter joining us from Manchester, England, and Carlos from Mexico City. I appreciate your time so much. And thanks again for the discussion.
Thank you, David, for inviting us. It was really wonderful.
Yes, thank you, David. It's been great.
Thank you for tuning in to New Books in Latino Studies. I'm David James Gonzalez, the host of today's podcast, and I hope you've enjoyed my conversation with Peter Wade and Carlos Lopez Beltran, co-editors, along with Eduardo Restrepo and Ricardo Ventura Santos of Mestizo Genomics, Race Mixture, Nation, and Science in Latin America, published by Duke University Press in 2014. If you'd like to get in contact with me, you may send me an email to newbooksinlatinostudies@gmail.com, or you may look for me on Twitter at DJGonzoPhD. You may also follow our social media channels on Twitter for New Books in Latino Studies, or also Facebook. And we invite you, of course, to comment on this podcast via iTunes or Stitcher. Thanks again.